Team Mitchell Oration was delivered by Professor Sir Richard Feacham. Sir Richard is Director of the Global Health Group at the University of California, San Francisco Institute for Global Health Sciences and Professor of Global Health at both UCSF and the University of California, Berkeley. A self-described creature of the aid industry, Sir Richard's long career in health, governance, and development has placed him in a valuable position to assess the aid industry and consider how it can be re-engineered to be more effective, both in terms of impact and spending. The sixth in the Mitchell Oration series, the 2018 lecture was opened by Professor Mike Calford, ANU Provost, and Mr. Harold Mitchell of the Mitchell Foundation.
Good evening, everyone. I think we'll make a start. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us this evening for the sixth lecture in our Mitchell Oration series, including those joining us at home on live streaming. My name is Ashley Bettridge, and I'm the manager of the Development Policy Centre, and it's my great honour to welcome you all here tonight on behalf of my colleagues. I would like to begin by acknowledging and celebrating the Ngunnawal people, the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, and to pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and future. Canberra winter. I would also like to extend a very warm welcome tonight to our speaker, Professor Sir Richard Feacham, and his wife Nilam, also an esteemed global health expert, for joining us here in chilly Canberra this evening. We are very much looking forward to hearing Sir Richard's views on the future of aid in these challenging times. We are also honoured to be joined here tonight by Mr. Harold Mitchell, our long-term supporter, after whom this lecture series is named. In my time at the centre, I've only missed one Mitchell Oration, and that was the very first one. It's something that we look forward to every year, and it's an important platform for thought-provoking debate. Harold's ability to see the potential in our then very small centre has provided many opportunities for all of us to grow in our professions and to make a contribution to research and practice. So we're all very grateful for his continued interest and support. I would now like to call upon our Provost, Professor Mike Calford, to welcome you on behalf of the University.
Thank you, Ashley, and thank you for that acknowledgement of the first Australians on whose lands we meet. It gives me great pleasure to welcome all of you here this evening on behalf of the University to one of the flagship events of the University's calendar, and of the Development Policy Centre based at the Crawford School of Public Policy, to the 2018 Annual Mitchell Oration, this being the sixth in the series. To Harold Mitchell, very warm welcome. Your continued support for this event and for the University is much appreciated by us, and it's an honour to have you here this evening, and we look forward to hearing from you in a few minutes. I'm also honoured to welcome our speaker, Professor Richard Feacham. Professor Feacham is Director of Global Health Group at the University of California, San Francisco Institute for Global Health Sciences, and Professor of Global Health at both University of California, San Francisco and University of California, Berkeley. We're very much looking forward to hearing your views on the way forward for the global aid industry in the 21st century. And I gather you're also going to let us know about something about your time here at ANU in the past. Look forward to that. Seed funding from the Harold Mitchell Foundation in 2012 has supported the Development Policy Centre to become the leading source of analysis on Australia's foreign aid. The Centre's experts contribute to a wide range of development issues relating to Australia's aid effort in the region and broader global trends. Tonight's opportunity to hear from an esteemed visiting expert, Professor Feacham, further deepens the quality of the development debates at ANU and across Australia's policy landscape. Sir Richard, we look forward to your reflections on the challenges ahead and your suggestions for change and reform. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Calford. I'd now like to call on Harold Mitchell to say a few words as well.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mike, for those very kind words. And I've forgotten that we spent time together last year. As we were walking in here, I was reminded of one thing, that the scariest words you could ever hear was, oops. I was going to shorten the night, was I?
Yes.
Yes, that's okay. And I think it was Ronald Reagan who said the scariest words you can ever hear, and I'm mindful as I landed in Canberra just a little while ago. He said, someone says, good evening, I'm here from the government and we're here to help. And as I was walking in here tonight, someone very kindly said I could speak for as long as I like. I won't do that at all. I remember here when I was the chairman of the National Gallery, a predecessor chairman had been Gough Whitlam, and we would invite Gough back from time to time. And he was just the most wonderful, marvellous man I got to know later in my life and his life, obviously, and he was tremendous. He loved to speak. And I had a rule that said no one could speak more than 3 minutes. And he said, of course, comrade, I'll speak 3 minutes. And at about the five-minute mark, his wonderful, wonderful wife in a loud stage whisper said, shut up, Gough, get off. And so I'm going to speak for 3 minutes, but that's taken up 1 minute of. This is the sixth Mitchell oration, and I'm pleased to be here tonight to just speak for one moment. I feel as if I'm amongst old friends of the ANU in every way, and particularly Stephen Howes, who I'd known before we became involved a little time at CARE and elsewhere. And it made just such a difference to the fact that I knew Stephen, and we were able to bring together, and it's a compliment to everything that the ANU has done in those 6 years, wider than just this lecture, I might say, Sir Richard, and I'll come to that in a moment. But everything that you've done, it's been brave to tell those that are in power and policy here in this city where they're wrong, and you've done that, and you've done that in a polite way. And it's been listened to, not as much as I'd like it to be, but over time I know that we'll be there in everything like that. I just want to just take 30 seconds to recognise something else, because someone said, how did all this come together? And as I was walking in, I should say, I saw a former Vice-Chancellor, wonderful, wonderful old friend, Jan Reid. Where are you, Jan? I'll probably, there you are. And I suddenly thought of the power of women. I should recognise Lady Nealon here in every way that you, and particularly a lady called Stephanie Copus Campbell, who's just four along there. And it was the power of women that we all, men are all the same. I say, okay, I'll do that. And Stephanie came to me too and said, this was such an important thing to do. In a world that was changing so dramatically, we could make a difference. And I've always pushed Steph to go on and run the UN or the World Bank, and she said, well, no, I don't want to do any of that. Who was it running the World Bank we ran into?
Jim Wolfertson,
that's right. Yeah, strange fellas, Jim. And the same with Jan, who got me to do one particular thing in Sydney, which was the education of young kids into this new world of communications and such, where everyone else had dropped and they didn't do like that. And so, Lady Nealon, tonight you fit in amongst the power of women, and more strength than all of you might say. I spent a minute this afternoon working out what Sir Richard Feasham had been up to. And Richard, as I just explained, I do not half an hour, it won't be that long, on the radio around the country at 7:30 tonight, so I'm going to talk about you, if you don't mind. You won't be listening, so I'll say anything I like. But incredibly distinguished in everything that you've done in global health, which fits into that. You started here in Sydney, but I was very thoughtful. Last week I was with Shadana Gujmar in East Timor, an old friend from a long way back. And again, I met Shadana actually because of his wife, who had been a Melbourne lady, his then wife. And they made me take all of those tablets to make sure that I didn't get malaria. You got malaria 50 years ago in the Solomons, and you didn't take the tablets, did you? But what you did learn was a lifelong passion of understanding about disease and health and the difference that it can make. And I know in my particular case, I've been involved with East Timor, Stephanie, of course, with Papua New Guinea. It's all fine here in Canberra. Life is all okay. It ain't out there. And where we can make a real difference in every way, that we do. I'm delighted that you could join us here tonight and to fit in with everything that we've done of, I think, the five speakers, or six before, is it? Again, amazing, incredible people. And as I look at the background of what you've done and where you are, you fit in exactly alongside all of them. I'm honoured to be here tonight, and we're delighted that you can join us tonight to talk to us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Harold. It's always great to have you here, and we're very glad you took the tablets and didn't get malaria, so you could join us as well. All right, it's time to move to tonight's main event. So I'd like to call on Professor Michael Wesley, the Dean of the ANU College of Asia and the Pacific, to chair the 2018 Mitchell Oration and to formally introduce our speaker. Please welcome Professor Wesley.
Thanks, Ashley, and thanks, Harold, and thanks, Mike. Ladies and gentlemen, the purpose of the Mitchell Oration is to provide a new forum at which the most pressing development issues can be addressed by the best minds and the most influential practitioners of our time from around the world. Since its founding in 2012, with the generous support of the Harold Mitchell Foundation, the Mitchell Oration has featured the likes of Timor-Leste's former finance minister, Emilia Perez, the World Bank's Jim Adams, and Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, board chair of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance. The 2018 Mitchell Oration will be delivered by Professor Sir Richard Feacham, a person who embodies what a difference an individual can make to millions of lives when they combine deep research expertise with passion to make a difference and a canny sense of policy realities. Research, passion, and policy engagement, commitments that are central to how we do things here at the ANU. Sir Richard is best known as the founding executive director of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis and Malaria, and as Under-Secretary General of the United Nations between 2002 and 2007. How he got there is a fascinating story. Before he even started studying, Sir Richard travelled to the Solomon Islands as a volunteer and built an airstrip on the weather coast of the Solomon Islands. And apparently on her first visit to Solomon Islands, current Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop asked, one of the first things she wanted to do was to go and visit Feacham's airstrip, and she did indeed. Sir Richard began his career as a medical scientist with degrees from the University of London, UNSW, and I think we can proudly claim Sir Richard as one of our alumni, because one of his supervisors was none other than my predecessor, Oscar Spate. His academic career was a stellar one, and he rose to become Dean of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine between 1989 and 1995. After this, his career took a more activist direction. Between 1995 and 1999, Sir Richard served as Director for Health, Nutrition and Population at the World Bank. He is currently Director of the Global Health Group at the University of California, San Francisco Institute for Global Health Sciences and Professor of Global Health at both UCSF and the University of California, Berkeley. Sir Richard's career is a monument to working across boundaries in the very different realms of research, activism and policy to make a difference to the lives of millions of people. In an interview with our own Professor Gabrielle Bammer back in 2015, which you can read on the Dev Policy blog site, he made a really intriguing observation. He said, if global malaria policy setting is done by researchers, we'll get the wrong answer. The research community needs to strongly be a part of a global disease enterprise. It needs to be feeding in great ideas, great insights, products and analyses to that global effort. But it should not be in charge, because when researchers are in charge, you get a long list of things we don't know, a long list of research priorities and a major statement that we need to be giving more money to answer these unresolved questions. This is not a criticism. I've been a researcher for a big chunk of my life. It's what researchers do. But the whole global effort needs to be led by policymakers, strategists, people from the financing institutions, and people who are focused on what we do know and what we can do with existing knowledge and existing technology, and who will aggressively pursue that. I think you'll agree, this is no ordinary academic. I can think of no better custodian of the 2018 Mitchell Oration. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Sir Richard Feacham to the lectern.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for that extremely kind introduction. Neelam and I are very happy to be here, very happy to be back in Australia and back in Canberra, and among so many old friends and colleagues in the audience. Thank you so much for coming. And it's a very great honour to be asked to give the 2018 Mitchell Oration. And thank you, Harold, for the inspiration of creating this series and for the honour of inviting us here for this particular evening. Unaccustomed as I am to orating, I checked the dictionary and found that to orate means to make a speech pompously and at great length, with the synonyms of pontificate, preach, sermonize, and sound off. So not what Harold intended, I'm sure, but you have been warned. So before I launch into the arcane mysteries of the aid industry, I want to declare two conflicts of interest which undoubtedly colour my opinions on aid. First, I am a creature of the aid industry. You've heard that in 1965, I swam ashore to a remote village on the weather coast of Guadalcanal, and 9 months later left by aeroplane because my task was to build an airstrip. And that work was done under the aegis of the British Volunteer Programme, VSO, Voluntary Service Overseas. And since that time, I have been part of the aid industry. I have been a recipient of aid, I've been a giver of aid, I've been a researcher on aid, I've been an advisor to aid agencies, and for most of my career, my salary has been paid by donors or foundations who are in the aid business. So I am clearly conflicted. Secondly, a second area of conflict relevant to this evening and to my remarks about Australia late in this presentation is that I have a long-standing love affair with Australia, which I must come clean about. I have visited Australia very many times since my first visit in 1965. I got married in Australia, but not to Neelam. But we should fix that, actually. I spent my honeymoon, bizarrely, in the library of the Research School of Pacific Studies at the Australian National University. And for the young lovers in the audience who are thinking about their honeymoon, I don't recommend it. Not a good idea. My daughter was born in Australia. I have degrees from two Australian universities. And over many years, I've worked very closely with Australian colleagues in both government and academia, some of whom are here tonight. And so my views on Australian aid are undoubtedly views through rose-tinted spectacles, and I give you due warning of that. So my talk tonight, and the subject tonight, is the aid industry, and I will concentrate mainly on that major part of the aid industry that is run by governments, the so-called ODA, Official Development Assistance. And I will also be talking mainly about aid as a whole, aid to all sectors, although I'll use a number of examples from the health sector, which is the part of aid that I know best. So, we're going to talk briefly about the structure of the aid industry, the origins of aid, the amount and generosity of aid, the aid debate, which is fascinating, some inconvenient truths about aid, some other opinions, the future, and then rather impertinently, I'm going to make a few remarks about Australian aid. And you know much more about that than I do, so I look forward to being contradicted. So let's move quickly through the early slides. The aid industry is, as you well know, comprised of bilateral institutions and multilateral institutions. It's all rather recent. It got underway after the Second World War. The World Bank got started in 1946, and the other organizations that you see there under the multilateral heading and the bilateral heading came into being through the 1950s and the 1960s. The two biggest bilateral agencies, USAID and Britain's DFID, the Department for International Development, were both created in 1960. And both multilateral institutions and bilateral institutions have proliferated. There are new players in both of those spaces. Bilateral, interesting, because not only do all the conventional OECD member countries have bilateral institutions, but some of them have more than one. So Bavaria and Catalonia and Wales have bilateral aid agencies, so they proliferate. And now beyond the members of OECD, countries like Brazil, India, China, and others have bilateral aid agencies. So these agencies are growing more numerous through time. And as far as official development assistance goes, the governmental part of development assistance, these are the key organizations. So very briefly to the origins of aid. Aid is about 70 years old, 60 or 70 years old as an industry. It has multiple and complex origins, but I'll quickly call out three origins. The first is the plan named after this gentleman, George Marshall, who was Secretary of State of the United States from 1947 to 1949, and was the architect of the Marshall Plan, the scheme which injected huge amounts of cash into war-torn Europe and Japan, was very short-lived, was large in scale, and was regarded as highly successful in putting those war-torn countries on their feet and unleashing very dynamic economic growth. And with only a few years later, Germany and Japan, two of the most destroyed countries, were major economies and major players in the industrial world. So there was a feeling that injections of cash in the short term could have big impact and could unleash self-sustaining economic growth. And the donors could then withdraw, as they did in the Marshall Plan, and let those economies grow under their own steam. Secondly, and most importantly, I think, was the age of decolonization. And it's interesting to remember that in 1946, the great majority of all countries in the world were run by somebody else. The great majority of all countries in the world were colonies, an extraordinary recent historical fact. And starting in 1946, the decolonization process got underway. There were three decolonizations in 1946, a French colony, a British colony, and an American colony. Anyone know who those three were? Any offers? 1946, decolonization. The French colony was Syria, the British colony was Jordan, and the American colony was the Philippines. Followed, of course, in 1947 by India and Pakistan, and followed in 1948 by Sri Lanka, and then a surge of decolonizations. And the modal year for decolonizations, the year having the most individual decolonizations, was 1960, when there were 18 decolonizations, including Nigeria. And the process went on into the 1970s, as you all know, and set up the conditions for ongoing transfer of resources from wealthy countries, the former colonial powers, to the former colonies, which became the aid industry. And a third origin and influence was, of course, the Cold War. The younger people in the audience may not remember something called the Soviet Union. It was quite a big deal in its day. It came to an end in 1990, but there was something called the Cold War from the end of the Second World War up till 1990, and the aid industry was a way to try and cultivate influence, and it was certainly a weapon and an instrument of the Cold War. So that's another important influence. So let's move now to the amount of aid and the generosity of aid, and look first at this graph. Along the horizontal axis, we have 1960 through to 2016. And let's look first at the blue line. The blue line is described on the left-hand vertical axis, and it's the total amount of official development assistance in standardized 2014 US dollars between 1960 and 2016. And it starts at about $40 billion per year, the blue line, and rises to today's number of about $145 billion per year. So it's gone up steadily, and since the year 2000, gone up quite rapidly. But during the same period, the wealth of the countries giving the aid, the wealth of the donor countries, has increased enormously. So the red line shows that other picture, which is the generosity of aid, measured by the total volume of aid, divided by the total GDP of the countries giving the aid, and expressed as a percentage. So this is aid collectively across all the giving countries as a percentage of combined GDP of all the giving countries. And we see a very different picture with the red line. We see aid starting off at about 0.6% of collective GDP, falling today to about 0.3% of collective GDP. So the dollars have gone up, but the generosity has come down and then plateaued. And let's break that out by country. And here we see a selection of countries. And please look only at the right-hand side of that graph. Look at 2016. And you see a less generous group down the bottom, represented by Australia, Japan, and the United States, and a more generous group up the top, represented by Scandinavians of various kinds, and Northern Europeans. And the generous group are above this magic figure of 0.7% of GDP. And you'll all be aware that the UN norm, the UN standard for what aid should be, a number with no real basis, but a widely accepted number, is 0.7% of GDP. And the Scandinavians and the Northern Europeans, and now remarkably the United Kingdom, are at or above 0.7% of GDP. Other countries are below that, and tending to sit down the bottom of the ranking is the United States and Japan, recently joined by Australia, which is at 0.23% of GDP and falling. A few years ago, Australia was aspiring to 0.5% of GDP, but it's been coming down steadily in recent years, and I think recent announcements put it at 0.19% of GDP, which would be the lowest figure in Australian history. And there are many other ways to express generosity. This breaks out aid for health. So here we're looking at just aid for the health sector, and looking at other ways to measure generosity. If you look at the middle column, dollars per numbers of citizens of the given, dollars per capita, where per capita is the population of the country doing the giving. And you see that Norway comes up on top. Every Norwegian gives $149 per year to health sector aid, whereas Spain down the bottom, every Spanish citizen gives $3 per year to health sector aid. Big differences. And another way of measuring it is not a percent of GDP, but a percent of government spend. And you see that on the right-hand column, with Norway well in the lead at 0.6% of government spend, and Spain well in the rear at 0.03% of government spend. And Australia is coming out roughly in the middle of that particular group of countries. $21 per Australian on health sector aid, or about 1.1% of the total Australian public expenditure on health sector aid. So we can look at these generosity comparisons in different ways. So let's come now to the aid debate. And an organization that carefully watches aid is the OECD in Paris, and particularly the DAC, the Development Assistance Committee of the OECD. And the Director General of the OECD in 2010 made the statement that aid is a vital investment with big returns for the world as a whole. And I've spent my life making statements like that, particularly at the time when I was raising billions of dollars for the Global Fund. But the question to pose in an academic setting is that actually true? And what is the evidence for and against an assertion of that kind? Now, that debate about what aid has achieved, what has been the impact of aid, is made much more complicated by what I call the great confounding. And the great confounding is the fact that during the period of the aid industry, shall we say 1950 up till today, we, Homo sapiens, have undergone a biological revolution that is absolutely extraordinary and fundamental. Poverty has gone down enormously in that 70-year period. Life expectancy has gone up enormously in that 70-year period, and fertility has gone down enormously in that 70-year period. And the magnitude of those changes are staggering. Let me briefly address each of them. In 1950, 75% of all humans lived in extreme poverty. 75% of all humans in 1950 lived in extreme poverty, and there were only 2.5 billion humans on the planet. Today, less than 10% of humans live in extreme poverty, and there are 7.6 billion of us on the planet. Quite extraordinary and remarkable. Life expectancy, the biggest story seldom told. Life expectancy from the origins of our species 300,000 years ago up until 1950 increased by 18 years, from 30, which is our baseline life expectancy, to 47 or 48, say 48. An increase in 18 years over 300,000 years. Since 1950, life expectancy has increased by 23 years, from 48 to 71. So put another way, life expectancy of our species has increased more in the last 70 years than in the previous 70,000 years. Quite extraordinary. Fertility in 1950 was 5 children per woman, and today it's 2.5. It has halved, and it approaches replacement level of 2.1. So Homo sapiens is converting itself in our lifetime from a high mortality, high fertility mammalian species, like most mammals, to a low mortality, low fertility species. This is a once in our history evolution of our species. It's happening during our lifetime. And it's happening during the time that the aid industry has existed. And this confounds our attempts to associate progress with aid. Is this remarkable journey because of aid, in part or in whole? Is it irrespective of aid? It would have happened with or without aid. Or is it perhaps controversially despite aid? It might have happened more or faster if we never had the aid industry. And interestingly, there are well-educated and thoughtful people who will get behind all three of those postulations, all three of those postulates, and that is the current aid debate. And you can see the aid debate in many ways. I tend to think of it as colourfully as a boxing match. And in one corner we have Jeff Sachs, the world's best-known macroeconomist. And in the other corner, well-known to all of you, I'm sure, and may well have spoken at the ANU. And in the other corner we have Bill Easterly, another famous and highly experienced macroeconomist. And my words, not theirs. Jeff is saying aid is good, more aid is better. And Bill is saying aid doesn't work, aid does harm. And that's a remarkable difference in view from two highly educated macroeconomists. And in the middle of the debate are the referees or the umpires. There are many of those. I'm going to single out Steve Radelet from the United States and Paul Collier from Oxford as thoughtful people in the middle of the debate. And increasingly and importantly, we have voices from the developing world itself entering into this debate. I'm calling out here voices from Africa, Dambisa Moyo from Zambia, John Gitongo from Kenya. There are, of course, others. Coming back briefly to Jeff, The End of Poverty, his best-known book, forward by Bono, who I've worked very closely with as a huge advocate for aid and a very dedicated person in the aid space. And a quote from Jeff, extreme poverty is a trap that can be released through targeted investments, and that's what aid is about. And here we have Bill, one of his books, The Tyranny of Experts, a quotation, the cause of poverty is the absence of political and economic rights, and the argument that aid undermines political and economic rights. Dambisa Moyo from Zambia, a distinguished macroeconomist, her well-known book, Dead Aid, a quotation, aid has been an unmitigated political, economic, and humanitarian disaster for most parts of the developing world. So clearly a shy person with rather wishy-washy opinions on this subject. And John Gitongo, I'm not aware that he's written a book, but there is a book about him which I strongly recommend. It's called It's Our Turn to Eat, written by Michaela Wrong, who was the East African correspondent for The Economist. And a quote from John, worried Westerners who so often seem to fall prey to a benign form of megalomania when it comes to Africa, would do well to accept that salvation is not theirs to bestow. So some challenging comments. Paul Collier, one of my favorite referees, his book, The Bottom Billion, his message is narrow the targets and broaden the instruments. And so to some inconvenient truths which underlie this aid debate. And I think of all the inconvenient truths, and there are many, I'm going to mention a few, of all the inconvenient truths, I think this one is the most challenging one. If you are a macroeconomist, I must digress to just share my favorite definition of macroeconomists and microeconomists. A microeconomist is someone who is wrong about particular things, whereas a macroeconomist is wrong in general. So keeping that in mind, if you are a macroeconomist, then you want to believe, you need to believe, that aid will accelerate growth in GDP per capita. That aided countries, other things being equal, controlling for all the confounding variables, countries receiving aid will see their GDP per capita grow faster than otherwise similar countries not receiving aid. There will be some association. And econometricians and macroeconomists have sought hard for that association and not found it. And one of the most respected and cited studies on this is by Rajan and Subramanian, published in the Review of Economics and Statistics in 2008. And this is their conclusion. No evidence that aid works, or that it works better in some policy or geographical environments, or that certain forms of aid work better than others, when by work they mean accelerate the growth of GDP per capita. It's very important to caveat that by what they mean by work. And if you're not a macroeconomist, and I'm not a macroeconomist, you may mean other things when you say work, and we'll come to that later. But this is a very important finding, because every aid agency in the world, the Brits, the Americans, the World Bank, the Australian aid effort, have in their mission state, alleviation of mission statement, the alleviation of poverty as their central goal. And if by that you mean increasing GDP per capita, then you're really putting the wrong target into your mission statement, because it seems to be the one thing that aid is not good at doing particularly. So there's an inconvenient truth. I'll go through a few others. This is what I call the global health supermarket fallacy. We look at a bad thing like maternal mortality. We work out the cost of averting one maternal death. We count the number of all maternal deaths in the world every year, 500,000. We multiply the number of dollars by 500,000, and we conclude that if we had X million dollars, we would be able to buy all those maternal deaths being averted. We would buy the elimination of those maternal deaths. So we call a conference in London, we raise all that money against maternal deaths, great cause, everybody feels really good about that, a fund is created, and then people move on to the next thing. But of course, the hard part is not raising that money. The hard part is turning that money into women not dying in childbirth. And that part is really, really difficult. And we often have too much focus on raising the cash and not enough focus on how to spend it to get the results that we want to get. And it's a perennial problem in the aid debate. Inconvenient truth number three, where does the money actually go? I think the taxpayers of Australia, and of course all aid money in the ODA space, comes from us, the taxpayers of wealthy countries. And I think the taxpayers of wealthy countries like to think that aid dollars go to the most needy in the most poor countries. And that's very far from the case, of course. And here we have the example of the United States. This is 2014 aid from the United States. It totaled $35 billion in 2014. And the top five recipients are listed here. And they are Israel, Egypt, Afghanistan, Jordan, and Pakistan in that order. One of those countries is wealthy. Very few of those countries are among the poorest countries in the world. And there's a clear and heavy geopolitical logic in that allocation of aid. It's clearly not about helping the neediest around the world. It's clearly about something else, which may be fine. That's not automatically a bad thing, but I think it's not what the taxpayer expects when they think of their money going to help less fortunate people around the world. Inconvenient truth number four, which has got a lot to do with China today and things that are appearing in the Australian newspapers every day, is the retreat from infrastructure. I love this cover. This is from June 1956. It's the 10th anniversary of the World Bank. And in those days, the World Bank's internal news magazine was wittily entitled Banknotes. And this was the cover on the 10th anniversary edition of Banknotes. And you see at the left, the male and female versions of the day of World Bank staff members and project developers. And you see them admiring their handiwork. And what are they admiring? They're admiring large quantities of concrete and steel used for various good purposes. So in the background, you can see a man-made lake, you can see a dam, you can see hydroelectricity, you can see major irrigation schemes, you can see the construction of large roads and cutting through hillsides to build roads. You can see railways, you can see ports, you can see industrial development, so it looks like a smelter in the foreground. In other words, infrastructure, 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 which is what the World Bank did in its early decades. And the Western-dominated aid agencies, both the multilaterals like the World Bank and the bilaterals, Australia and others, have to a significant degree retreated from infrastructure. And the modern edition of banknotes would somehow illustrate governance. Not sure how you'd illustrate that. Or female empowerment, or the health sector, or education. They would not focus on large amounts of steel and concrete. And that's provided a major opening for China, which we witness every day, not only in Africa, but also in Asia, and most recently in the Solomon Islands and Vanuatu. China's rapidly growing and very large aid program arrives country by country and says, what do you want us to build? Give us some big thing that we can build. And Vanuatu says, a port. And China says, yes. And the Solomon Islands says, an airport. And China says, yes. And these things get built very quickly. So China's rise in this business is strongly linked to the desperate need for infrastructure, the huge backlog of infrastructure, and China's willingness to provide it quickly. Inconvenient truth number five, aid dependency. Coming to the health sector here, an example from the health sector. Here we see external aid for health, foreign money for health, called DAH, Development Assistance for Health, as a percent of the domestic spend on health. So how much does the country spend domestically of its own money, so-called government health expenditure, and how much money from outside is going into the health sector? And if you are a red country, and there are quite a few red countries, the answer is more than 100%. In other words, the foreign money being spent on health in Malawi is larger than the domestic money being spent on health in Malawi. And that makes Malawi highly vulnerable to the whims of the donor agencies. You know, if Trump cuts the US aid budget enormously, as he may, he hasn't done yet, but if he does, countries around the world don't just have a minor upheaval, they have lots of people dying within weeks. Particularly if you remember that quite a large chunk of this aid dependency in the health sector is antiretroviral treatment. And when antiretroviral treatment stops, then mortality starts rising within a few weeks. So there is jeopardy, there is aid dependency, not only for the recipient countries, but also for the donors themselves, particularly in the arena of HIV. And we need to do a lot more hard thinking about how to escape from that. Inconvenient truth number six, this whole question of additionality or substitution. We live in a dream world in the aid business in regard to additionality or substitution. We believe that the world looks like this graph. The blue is the government expenditure. The government is spending that amount in year one. And then along comes aid. Germany gives that Ministry of Health $50 million for year two, and that's shown in red, so expenditure goes up. And then if that money was to go away in year three, then the country concerned would still be spending what it has been spending, and that's year three. So that the aid is fully additional, and if the aid goes away, the domestic expenditure stays solid where it was before. And indeed, we sometimes think that in a smart country, the blue lines would be rising through time. So the domestic expenditure would be going up. And once again, the aid would be icing on the cake. It would be additional finance in order to do more. And if that finance went away, you'd still have your rock solid base of domestic commitment. Another possibility is that in year one, you're spending your own money in the way shown. In year two, foreign money comes in, and the Minister of Finance says to the Minister of Health, oh, you've just got $50 million from Germany, so I'm taking $50 million out and spending it on something else. So domestic goes down because international has arrived, and the total is not the sum of the two. The total is less than the sum of the two. In other words, we don't have full additionality. We have a degree of substitution. In some countries, full substitution. In some countries, the Minister of Finance will take out the total quantum that the foreigners are providing. And then you have the third possibility, that you're spending in year one your blue amount, the aid comes in year two, so you reduce your blue amount, and when the aid goes away in year three, the blue amount might bounce back a little bit, but not to where it was before, because that's too difficult for the Ministry of Finance to do. And extensive research by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in Seattle has shown that it's this third graph, it's what you're looking at now, which is the reality in country after country after country. In the great majority of countries, there is significant aid substitution, and as aid is reduced, domestic expenditure does not bounce back to its previous level. And that is extremely concerning, and a matter which the aid agencies, including the one that I'm so associated with, the Global Fund, need to address much more vigorously. And my last inconvenient truth is that in places like Washington, D.C., with masses of hubris, people like to believe that aid makes people love us, that Americans are more liked in the world if they give lots of aid to countries, and the people of those countries will think better of them. Same perhaps for Germans, same perhaps for Australians, that we win affection, that we win hearts and minds by giving aid. I have no data on this topic, I'm sure there is some, but I have 50 years of experience of talking to people in countries around the world, from remote villages through to leaders of industry and government, and I have never encountered this phenomenon. I have never encountered that my country, the United Kingdom, or some other country like France or Germany or Australia, is better regarded because of the aid it gives. The views around the world of Australia or the United States or the United Kingdom are governed by a number of other macro geopolitical issues, and aid, in my experience, does not feature in that equation. So lots of good reasons to give aid, but I think to make people like us is not one of them in practice, and should not be. So very briefly, other opinions. I think we have to make reference to the 2016 Nobel laureate in economics, Angus Deaton, and his book, The Great Escape. He has some strong things to say about aid. The record of aid shows no evidence of any overall beneficial effect. That's a bit of a slap in the face. And aid does harm. That dedicated and ethical people are doing harm to people who are already in such distress is not the least of the tragedies of aid. His book is worth reading. It's actually more nuanced than those quotes suggest, but he certainly does have an overall negative view. There are lots of other researchers and writers about the aid industry, as you're well aware. And one of the interesting movements that's gaining traction is the Just Give Money to Poor People movement, with some interesting randomized controlled trials in East Africa looking at the impact of that approach. And when they talk about just give cash to poor people, as we do in Australia, as we do in all rich countries, we give cash to poor people to allow them to get above the poverty line and live a reasonable life. What they mean is give cash to poor women. Don't give cash to poor men. And the evidence on the value of giving cash to poor women is generally very positive, and it has positive impacts on their families and on their children. The assumption is that men will go smoking and drinking and engage in nefarious activities, but women don't. And so it's really a give money to poor women proposal with growing evidence behind it. I've been hiding behind other opinions. What are mine? Very briefly, I think aid has done much to create focused irreversible change, of which smallpox eradication is the outstanding example of our time. And again, concentrating on the health sector, to create focused but reversible change, HIV treatment. When we launched the Global Fund in 2002, the number of people in the developing world on antiretroviral therapy was essentially zero. Today, there are 20 million people across the developing world taking their antiretroviral therapy, three-drug, four-drug, combined pill every morning. Absolutely remarkable. We would never have thought we could have done that, but we have. And those 20 million people are given their lives back and have a normal life expectancy and are workers and parents and contribute to their societies. So huge achievements through the work of the aid industry. But these changes are reversible, and we have to be very, very alert to the dangers of going backwards. Aid has done little, in my experience, we're coming back to the macroeconomist view here, to drive economic growth or long-term broad and deep improvements in welfare. Countries have done well with good policies, whether aided or not, and countries have done poorly with poor policies, whether aided or not. And aid has done harm by encouraging or perpetuating dysfunctional governance and policies which it would have otherwise come to an end sooner. A number of classic examples of that, but other less recognized examples of that, such as India's expenditure of less than 1% of GDP on health, an outrageous situation, aided and abetted by foreign aid to India, which picks up some of the more high-profile programs like HIV and tuberculosis. The future. I have no magic ball to look into. There are many experts on this subject in the room, so I'll just mention a few building blocks that might be helpful as we think about the future. There's something real, I think, in the new aid paradigm. In the 1960s, aid was supply-driven and input-focused. And I think we have a commitment today for aid to be demand-driven and outcome-focused. And along with that, we have at least a rhetorical commitment to a purchaser-provider split, to aid being pro-private sector, incredibly important. Aid has so often crowded out the private sector. And of course, developing countries need a very prosperous and vigorous private sector. We must be very careful not to give aid in a way that actually undermines the role of the private sector. Dual accountability by both the donor and the recipient. Extreme transparency. Everything on the website. Everything. Everything on the website. Because only then can the whistleblowers blow their whistle. Only then can taxpayers of the giving countries know how their money is being spent. Very few aid agencies live up to that, because they have legal departments who come into the office of the chief executive and say, you can't put that on the website, it's too delicate. To which the answer is nonsense. Put it on the website. And longer term and more predictable aid flows. Critical for ministers of finance to work their juggling act of working out how much money they're going to have next year. Now, there is rhetorical commitment to the newer elements of that agenda, but not a great deal of actual putting into practice. So let's look at the aid reform agenda and mention perhaps a few building blocks. The first one, well described in this quote from Steve Radlett, is the non-aid development agenda. How can we promote development in Asia Pacific in ways other than giving aid? And his quote is, aid is not the most important policy tool rich countries have to influence growth and development. Much greater influence comes through trade and investment policies. And I think there's a lot of evidence for that. So thinking trade, thinking finance, thinking investment policies and creating level playing fields. And of course, the trade war that Trump is unleashing as we sit here is hugely damaging to our steady progress in this direction. Secondly, maintain momentum with key initiatives. We have some global initiatives that are going really well. Let's stay on them. In the health sector, polio eradication, almost done. Let's get it finished. Childhood immunization, revolutionized in the last 20 years through Gavi, which Australia has played a major role in. HIV/AIDS prevention and treatment. I mentioned we've gone from 0 to 20 million people on antiretroviral therapy in less than 2 decades. And Bill Bucktell in the audience has played a huge role in that, as have others here. Quite remarkable. Malaria control and elimination. Sri Lanka eliminated malaria 5 years ago. Back in the 1930s, Sri Lanka had 6 million cases of malaria at a time when its population was 6 million people. The last few years, Sri Lanka has had no malaria at all. Remarkable. China ended 2017 with no malaria for the first time in 5,000 years. Remarkable. Let's keep on it. Neglected tropical diseases. Again, huge progress against these obscure worms and other neglected tropical diseases. With renewed concern for sustainability, because these things can all go backwards. Aid reform agenda number 3, let's worry about the countries that actually would collapse if aid was turned off tomorrow. And I think there are two ways of thinking which countries that they might be. The first is this way. Let's look at countries that combine very low GNI per capita, for example, less than $600, with small population size, for example, 20 million. There are only, whatever that is, 9 countries in the world that have both those properties, that have GNI of less than $600 per capita and populations of less than 20 million, and here they are. And they're examples of countries which, if foreign flows were turned off, they would probably collapse as nation states. But there's another category that don't fit that GNI and don't fit that population, but for which the same is probably true, well known to Australia, which is the small island nations. So if you look across the Pacific and the small island nations, their GNI per capita is way above 600. Their populations are very small, but they are very fragile and vulnerable. And I think you can argue that a number of them would collapse as functioning nation states if all foreign dollars were switched off. And so we have to really grapple with a 21st century way to keep those countries alive and growing and developing until such time as they really can economically stand on their own feet. It is possible. Neelam and I have just come from the Maldives. The Maldives is a country with no natural resources except for some fish, and was incredibly poor and incredibly dependent on British aid flows, which is now doing rather well and is a middle-income country with a rising GNI per capita. So others can do it. Invest in leadership, aid reform agenda number 4. We've lived under this myth that the important education is all primary education. Not true. Australia needs leading universities, so does Vietnam, so does Indonesia, so does Cambodia. Everybody needs the apex of the education pyramid, not just the base of the education pyramid. So let's invest in universities, particularly in Asia Pacific for Australia. Let's create well-funded, long-term, co-managed partnerships between rich country schools of medicine, engineering, management, for example, and middle-income, low-income university schools of engineering, management, medicine, for example. Long-term, co-managed partnerships to the benefit of both the wealthy country institution and the poorer country institution. And open up more development-related fellowships where future leaders and aspiring leaders can come and do postgraduate study in Australia and in other wealthy countries and go back home and provide that much needed leadership, both in the private sector and the public sector. Aid reform agenda number 5 is occurring, and it's this move away from aid to countries and towards aid for global public goods. So moving away from aid to Cambodia and towards aid for regional collective action, regional shared goals. And this is occurring. Australia is doing more and more of it. I think it's very much a direction of the future. A very good example is Australia's support for APOMA and APMEN, run by Dr. Ben Rolfe in the audience in Singapore, representing a regional collective action initiative addressing a regional public good, malaria elimination in Asia, and a good way to use Australian dollars on that collective regional enterprise rather than thinking just country by country by country. So in conclusion, let me come to Australia with a good deal of trepidation. There must be many people in this room, I certainly hope there are many people in this room, who know much more about the Australian aid program than I do, because I know very little about the Australian aid program. So with trepidation, let me attempt a couple of comments. And I approach this by doing a kind of thought experiment and asking some questions to myself about what I might do if I was running the Australian aid program. And then I compared that with what the Australian aid program actually does. So how much? Well, in 2012 it was 0.36% of GDP. It's now 0.22% of GDP. And it's falling. I gather it's going to become 0.19% of GDP. So those are interesting numbers. The quantum of aid is not the most important thing about aid. The most important thing about aid is how you choose to spend it. But obviously the quantum matters. So those numbers are certainly on the low side. Public goods, international collective action. Global public goods, yes, I would certainly invest in global public goods, such as the Global Fund and such as relevant research, and Australia does that. Regional public goods, yes, particularly embodied, I think, by the recent initiatives by Australia in regional health security. Very good example of doing that. I certainly applaud that direction. Aid to countries, well, firstly, which regions? Asia Pacific, I would say a resounding yes. Rest of the world, I would say no. And that's what Australia does. Australia's aid is highly focused on Asia Pacific. And only when Australia is trying to get a seat on the UN Security Council is there a kind of flirtation with aid to Africa, which quickly comes to an end, and quite rightly, in my opinion. So Asia Pacific, yes. Which countries? Small and fragile countries, I would say yes, and it is the case. Other countries, I would say question mark, needs quite a bit of thought and justification. What sectors? Health and education, I would say yes. And I'd also make a big plug for infrastructure. And I'd also make a big plug for leadership, and we'll come in a moment to see what Australia actually does. And then a final very challenging question, I think, is all this done with China or somehow against China? Very much in the news today, does one try and join forces with China in some of these initiatives? There are examples of that. Does one work in a complementary, parallel way with China and simply try to coordinate? Or is it some sort of competition where we are trying to make our aid more useful than their aid? And I think there are some elements of all those discussions going on right now. And that issue is going to become larger and larger for Australia in the coming years. So let's look quickly at Australia's aid plans for 2018 to 2019. One third is global and two thirds are Asia Pacific. So is Australia investing in global collective action, in multi-country global initiatives? Yes, to the tune of about one third, which is more than most other bilateral aid efforts, and two thirds going more country-focused efforts, very much in Asia Pacific. And another way to cut the cake and think of it is roughly half is to countries, and almost all the country aid is to Asia Pacific. So here are some of the numbers breaking down by global, Asia Pacific regional, Asia Pacific country, rest of the world, and the totals. And some interesting balancing acts here. As we see, a significant investment in global initiatives, a significant investment in regional Asia-Pacific initiatives, a much larger investment in countries in Asia-Pacific, very small investments in the rest of the world, all coming to a little over 4 billion Australian dollars. And if we look at the countries concerned in Asia-Pacific, there are 27 of them by my count, essentially everything from Afghanistan eastwards, except China, India, North Korea, and Thailand. And only three of those countries receiving more than $100 million per year, those being PNG, Indonesia, and the Solomon Islands. So money focused on countries in Asia Pacific, but spread pretty thinly across a rather large number of countries. My thoughts on how that might change. I think I would be interested in switching away from Asia Pacific country support and more into Asia Pacific regional collective initiatives. In parallel with that, I would think of getting this number of 27 down. That's a large number of countries to be giving relatively small amounts of money to. And of course, I would be interested in pushing up this total figure. If we come to sectors, Australia is spending about 27% of its aid on health and education, infrastructure and trade about 19%, and building resilience and effective governance 38%. And I'm not entirely sure what the content of those headings is. I think there's an argument for increasing the infrastructure and trade components, for taking a hard look at the building resilience and effective governance component and what is really in that and what is that really buying, and for thinking very seriously about leadership with strong linkages to the great Australian universities, which I think is a real win-win proposition for Australia. So, some provocative thoughts about the aid industry. I hope everyone here will join in these debates. Women wanted for hazardous journey in reforming the aid industry. Small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honour and recognition in case of success. I'm not sure about the last one, but we need all women on deck to create this reform in the aid industry. So from the People's Democratic Republic of California, thank you very much. Thank you very much for listening.
My name's Stephen Howes. I'm the director of the Development Policy Centre, and I now stand between you and drink, so I'm going to be very brief. But I would like to thank our speaker, Richard Feacham, for coming all this way and giving such a stimulating talk. There are many things I'd like to say in response to the talk. But I will, in a self-serving manner, I will say that here our school, our centre and the school, has a very large partnership with the University of Papua New Guinea, School of Business and Public Policy. Certainly ANU's largest, perhaps Australia's largest, so it's very interesting to hear you single that out as something we should be doing more of. I'd like to thank Harold and Stephanie for their ongoing support as well as their attendance here tonight. I'd like to thank all my colleagues at the ANU from the province down for all their support and the hard work that goes into putting an event like this on tonight. I want to thank our live streaming, Damien and his team, and also Radio National, Big Ideas, for recording today's event. So look out for it on the radio. I'd like to thank the Asia-Pacific Leaders Malaria Alliance, who've also helped us put tonight's event on. And finally, I'd like to thank you all for venturing out on a rather cold Canberra night. I'm sure you found it worthwhile, and you'll find it even more worthwhile and rewarding if you do stay behind for drinks. So I encourage you to do that. And I now ask you to give Sir Richard Feacham a round of applause and then head for the exit.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea, the Pacific and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter to get all the latest updates, or you can connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.